I'm at this age now where I have to get my readers on. But Founding Father Thomas Jefferson genuinely believed in freedom of the press throughout his life. Writing from France in the late 1780s, he said, "Our liberty depends on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost." He once said that if he had to choose between a government without the press or a press without the government, he would not hesitate for a moment to prefer the latter. He knew that a free press is necessary to Republican self-government and a hallmark of a free society. He and his colleagues understood that freedom of the press is rooted in the natural right to be able to seek the truth. Yet our second president was also a vociferous critic of the press. In 1806, he said, "As for what is not true, you will always find abundance in the newspapers." And nothing can now be believed which is seen in a newspaper. Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put into that vehicle, into that polluted vehicle. Adding, "The man who never looks into a newspaper is better informed than he who reads them, inasmuch as he who knows nothing is nearer to truth than he whose mind is filled with falsehoods and errors." Contrary to what many media figures claimed during the Trump presidency, there is no contradiction in Jefferson being both a great defender of the free press and a ferocious critic of what the press did with its freedom. In fact, the positions are complementary when the press is failing to uphold its noble aims. Those who abuse natural rights, whether with regard to self-defense, speech, assembly, press, or otherwise, are a threat to the culture of liberty. They can also be a threat to their own existence. Gawker, an online gossip rag, so egregiously violated its victims' privacy rights that a jury forced it to pay $140 million, effectively shuttering it. Public opinion polls show the media's relationship with its audience is fraying, even as the media have as much power as ever. Much of corporate media has gained not just the distrust of the people, but their visceral contempt. The U.S. ranks last among 46 countries in terms of how its citizens trust the media. The credibility crisis is particularly acute among conservatives. 3 out of 4 Americans on the right said coverage of their views is unfair. A 2020 Gallup poll showed that while 73% of Democrats trust the media to report the news accurately, only 36% of independents and a barely there 9% of conservatives or of Republicans say the same. The main thing keeping the media afloat in these polls is that polled Democrats greatly appreciate the media's never-ending work on their behalf. Complaining vociferously about the press is a Republican Party tradition dating at least to Dwight Eisenhower. He received a prolonged standing ovation at his 1964 convention speech when he attacked the media. At nearly every campaign stop that President George H.W. Bush made during his unsuccessful reelection effort in 1992, he would display his favorite bumper sticker, which I might have had on my truck as well, "Annoy the media, reelect Bush." Political candidates as different as Richard Nixon and John McCain made similar complaints. The political media leading up to the 2016 presidential campaign were bad, but in a way that many voters had mostly grown used to. Much of the Republican Party and conservative establishment seemed to accept that systematic media bias was something they just had to live with. Many acted with such deference to the media as if to give the impression they believed they deserved the second-class treatment that they received. Donald Trump wasn't the first politician to push back on media corruption, but he was inarguably the most effective to do so. He was immune to their normal tricks at constraining the politicians they opposed. Unlike typical Republicans, when the media declared him racist for holding conservative policy positions, he declined to moderate his position. If anything, he doubled down on them. Knowing the media were not just political opponents, but his primary political opponents, he treated them as such, refuting the false assumptions in their questions and highlighting their errors when they invented anonymous sources and storylines as part of their attack. Journalists, so eager to expose wrongdoing in those they cover, handled the pushback very poorly. Already mendacious and unethical prior to the 2016 campaign, the corporate press got even worse. Journalists justified and embraced their departure from whatever norms they claimed to hold. New York Times media writer Jim Rutenberg published a front-page piece headlined, "Trump is testing the norms of objectivity in journalism." Leaving aside the laughable claim that journalism had such norms, he advised reporters to throw out the textbook American journalism had been using, to move away from a model of balanced coverage and to become openly oppositional. And so the biased political press corps overtly embraced their role as Democrat Party propagandists. Americans watched in 2016 as they used all their power and violated every norm to try and elect a favored candidate. They peddled fantastical Democrat campaign opposition research, mischaracterized Trump's positions, lambasted and caricatured his supporters, and were completely shocked and appalled, and, more than anything else, utterly embarrassed, when their smug assurance Trump wouldn't win proved to be false. Rather than realize they were completely out of touch with the country they purported to cover and endeavor to understand the issues of concern to the country, they instead pushed a false and dangerous conspiracy theory. It wasn't so much that they were wrong to assure voters Trump had no chance of winning. No, it was that the 2016 election had been stolen by Trump, who was an agent of Russia. The lie dominated news coverage for years. Dozens of stories each day fed a convoluted conspiracy theory based on leaks from anonymous Democratic partisans and anonymous intelligence officials. The theory imploded upon the completion of a massive federal investigation that was launched to undermine the Trump administration. In the end, not only had Trump not colluded with Russia to steal the 2016 election, not a single American had been found to collude with Russia to steal the 2016 election. Instead, the investigators tried in their thinly veiled impeachment report to claim that Trump complaining that the investigation was a witch hunt meant he had obstructed justice. That argument didn't fly, but only because a courageous attorney general called their bluff. Yet the media kept peddling this dangerous and false lie. It didn't bother them that they were harming international relations with a nuclear superpower, or that they spent hours each day for 3 years undermining the legitimacy of the 2016 election. It didn't bother them that they were scaring decent men and women away from important positions as political appointees. The founders had understood the press as important to the development of the ideals of Republican government. They may have very well found the entire Russia conspiracy theory to have been seditious. For the media, though, lying about anything Trump-related, while claiming that Trump alone was a liar, became a daily occurrence. They pushed out other outlandish conspiracy theories, such as the claim that a distinguished federal judge who had been nominated to the Supreme Court was secretly a serial gang rapist roaming the streets of suburban Maryland. They lied about a teenage boy who had attended a pro-life march in D.C. They became the main proponents of an impeachment, conspiring with political allies to hide key information about the plot. What worried the media and other partisans by 2020, though, was that Trump had somehow survived the onslaught. Worse, it looked like he would likely be the winner of the 2020 presidential election. The economy was flying high with job and wage increases for women and minorities. Peace was breaking out all over the world with brokered agreements between Israel and neighboring Muslim countries. It was in this context that the media began covering the global pandemic erupting out of China. Surely, a global pandemic that would take the lives of millions would be reason to focus on truth-telling, right? Instead, nearly all coverage was viewed through the prism of whether it helped or hurt the bad orange man. Corporate media censored and forbade discussions about the likely origin of the virus, effective treatments for it, and appropriate responses to it. American media behaved so poorly that international surveys of media consumers showed that America was the only country to have a lower opinion of the press following COVID than prior. The country has long had a biased press, and even one that has a track record of mendacity. At the same time, the current press and the conditions feeding it are so corrupt that the republic and our culture of liberty are experiencing actual harm. The media's behavior in recent years is driving people away from support of the press and creating great distrust. Whatever remains of their salutary effects on the public is waning. While trust in media is about as low as it can go, the corporate press still retain a tremendous amount of power. They set the agenda for Washington, D.C. If they want to impeach a president, they do. If they want to hide a story, the story will be kept out of public discussion. If they want to have their opponents banned from social media, they order it up. The political uniformity of the major media, journalistic standards that range from non-existent to hypocritical, the censorship power of the tech oligarchs who back and distribute the media, and billionaires and corporate owners who are desperate to retain and gain power, contribute to the media having outsized power to push their agenda. They are far and away the most powerful and unaccountable political actors in the country. Jefferson believed the media were key to America's Republican form of government. No experiment can be more interesting than what we are now trying, and which we trust will end in establishing the fact that man may be governed by reason and truth. Our first object, he wrote, should therefore be to leave open to him all the avenues to truth. The most effectual hitherto found is the freedom of the press. Contemporary journalism is a threat to the Republic because many of its practitioners don't value reason and truth so much as narrative. They believe their job is to frame information and declare how the public should perceive information. The first step to healing the Republic is to deny the corrupt media the power they have. Media critic and anarchist Michael Malice says, "The battle is won when the average person regards a corporate journalist exactly as they do a tobacco executive." Many on the right might say that the country is already there, but that's not quite true. Media credibility is near zero for its regular victims, but the media still retain power and prestige. Much of that is granted improbably by its worst victims. Look at how the Virginia Republican Party has responded to years of mistreatment from the propagandist Chuck Todd of MSNBC. For years, Todd berated and mocked Republicans who even mildly fought back against the media narrative that Trump had colluded with Russia to steal the 2016 election. Day after day and week after week, he would invite co-conspirators in that lie onto the show, where he would gently encourage them to talk about the stolen 2016 election. He said that people who had problems with the FBI spying on an opposing party's presidential campaign were liars or misinformed. He lamented with John Brennan, former CIA head who had been caught lying to Congress, among other things, about how some conservatives had been mean to him. Todd also spent years advocating against gun rights, a pet issue for him. He cared so deeply about it that he attacked Republican House leader Steve Scalise for not joining him in his anti-gun views after Scalise had nearly been killed by a left-wing gun-wielding activist. So in response, the Virginia GOP asked Chuck Todd to moderate a debate between his co-partisan Terry McAuliffe and Republican Glenn Youngkin. Republican politicians, by and large, haven't boycotted or even criticized the left-wing propagandists on cable, on network television, or in print who spewed the lie that Trump stole the 2016 election. Therefore, there has been no incentive for them to stop their propaganda. In his essay against the overuse of speculation in the media, Michael Crichton wrote of something called the Gell-Mann amnesia effect. "You open up the newspaper to an article on some subject you know well," he wrote. "You read the article and see the journalist has absolutely no understanding of either the facts or the issues. Often the article is so wrong, it actually presents the story backward. You read with exasperation or amusement the multiple errors in a story, and then you turn the page to national or international affairs and read as if the rest of the newspaper was somehow more accurate about Palestine than the baloney you just read. You turn the page and forget what you know." That amnesia is what has fueled media power for decades. Thankfully, their behavior is so undeniably corrupt that many Americans have finally lost that amnesia. But particularly for people in positions of power, that amnesia, combined with a fetish for humiliation or a pathological desire to be liked, have led too many to cooperate with a group that should be shunned and denied access. Far more preferable is to mock them, such as is done with the brilliant eviscerations provided by the Babylon Bee, a Christian satire site. The debate about the policy proposals and issues of the day is of vital importance. It doesn't happen with the uniform groupthink of the current corporate media, which must be marginalized. But it must happen. Andrew Breitbart wrote, "The left does not win its battles in debate. It doesn't have to. In the 21st century, media is everything. The left wins because it controls the narrative. The narrative is controlled by the media. The left is the media. Narrative is everything. I call it the Democrat media complex." While destroying the corrupt press is a noble goal, the country needs a free and functioning press to to hold the government and other powerful interests accountable. It is not sufficient to tear down the rotten outlets. Good journalism must be funded. Left-wing media outlets enjoy the massive support, not just of left-wing donors, but also of corporate interests. It's money very well spent. In August, former President Trump mocked the losses facing The Atlantic magazine. It's good to see The Atlantic magazine is losing large numbers of readers and a fortune of money. Only a widow of Steve Jobs and her boyfriend would keep it going. People think it will close soon, but who knows? So he's correct that most major media have lost credibility and that The Atlantic is hemorrhaging money and subscribers. There was an NBC report in July that they lost $20 million last year and were on track to lose another $10 million this year. But major Democratic donors such as Lorraine Powell Jobs should consider those losses a remarkably low price to pay for controlling the outcome of elections. The Atlantic doesn't exist to put out journalism or make money, but to control narratives. And even with significantly declining quality of its journalism, a sufficiently deranged and gullible establishment is more than happy to lap it up and spread the propaganda around. It was The Atlantic, after all, that cooked up the false and damaging Ayn Marne cemetery hoax that played such a large role in determining the outcome of that of the 2020 election. For that error-riddled, unsubstantiated, and completely debunked story, Atlantic editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg claimed to have a few secret anonymous sources who said that Donald Trump attacked dead World War I soldiers. He later admitted the central thesis of the story was likely wrong, but that was no barrier to the entirety of the corporate media running to amplify its claims. I should note that there were more than 20 on-the-record stories, on-the-record sources debunking that report, including people who loathe Donald Trump, such as John Bolton. That the fake news story came out at the same time as the real news story of yet another Trump-brokered Middle East peace deal was the icing on the cake. The left-wing media are able to control narratives despite their weakened credibility, not just because they retain so much power over establishment opinion, but because the media outlets that are waging war against their disinformation are so weakly funded. To preserve the republic, Americans must fund those outlets fighting back. Tocqueville said of newspapers, "To suppose that they only serve to protect freedom would be to diminish their importance. They maintain civilization." He specifically said that the more newspapers that exist, the less likely there will be centralized government and despotism from the state. He feared what would happen with a unified press. The founders supported freedom of the press, but not unchecked. Benjamin Franklin warned about a press that viewed itself as the entire court with the power to judge, sentence, and condemn to infamy citizens both public and private. The press even conducts something akin to hearings and trials. But unlike real courts, there is no accountability or order to how it conducts its business. It isn't restrained by jurisdiction or precedent. Arthur Millick writes in an essay on Franklin's views, "Not stopping at public figures, the press also satisfies its penchant for crushing the will of private citizens and groups through shame and fear, making them feel their smallness and brittleness. Its behavior, in sum, often discloses the press's tacit opinion concerning America's moral hierarchy, that the press is not merely a fourth estate, but the judge of would-be rulers and therefore the master, or at least the kingmaker. As journalists make decisions about which facts to gather, whether to grant anonymity, whether to cultivate or invent sources, who they will target, they are affecting the lives and reputations of people. They can destroy families, careers, lives. The founders believed that, like all freedoms, freedom of the press is not without limits. Since the landmark 1964 Supreme Court decision, New York Times versus Sullivan, those limits have been almost non-existent. In that decision, the court set the burden of proof on those public people who seek damages for libel to actual malice. That decision has given the press far more power over those who it has defamed. The actual malice standard means that a defamed person has to prove that a journalist knew what he wrote was wrong or that he showed a reckless disregard for the truth. No other freedom mentioned in the Constitution is treated like New York Times versus Sullivan standard treats the press. People have the right to practice their religion and keep and bear arms, and there's no actual malice standard regarding the wrongful actions of people practicing those rights. In practice, what this means is that a reporter who has failed to properly investigate a story, is biased or motivated to cause harm, fails to give victims a chance to comment, or uses compromised sources, will not be found to have behaved with actual malice. In the nearly 60 years since Sullivan was handed down, the behavior of media organizations has been warped by the overly broad protections afforded them. They know they can brazenly target political opponents without fear of any legal consequence. Many advocates instead seek a standard of negligence, such as the standard used for people who seek damages from negligent doctors. Courts have also greatly broadened who is deemed to be a public person in a lawsuit, coming up with a category of limited use public official. The courts have determined landlords, belly dancers, and taxicab managers are limited use public officials and therefore can't sue for defamation. In fact, with the press having more freedom than at any time in American history, the only check on bad behavior by the press is an individual journalist's sense of shame. It is possible that there is not anything in shorter supply in the country. There is some powerful support for revisiting this issue in the courts. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a recent concurrence in which he said it was time to revisit New York Times versus Sullivan, noting that the decision wasn't based in the Constitution, but was merely the policy of the justices who wrote it. None of these decisions made a sustained effort to ground their holdings in the Constitution's original meaning. As the court itself acknowledged, the rule enunciated in the New York Times case is largely a judge-made rule of law, the content of which is given meaning through the evolutionary process of common law adjudication. Thomas noted the libel rules they adopted broke sharply from what was held in the common law, and that the First and 14th Amendments didn't displace that common law. The common law of libel at the time the First and 14th Amendments were ratified did not, this is a Thomas quote, did not require public figures to satisfy any kind of heightened liability standard as a condition of recovering damages. Typically, a defamed individual needed only to prove a false written publication that subjected him to hatred, contempt, or ridicule. In fact, Thomas noted, far from increasing a public figure's burden in a defamation action, the common law deemed libels against public figures to be, if anything, more serious and injurious than ordinary libels. Federal judges are raising the alarm about other media issues as well. The control of major media by one political party is a dangerous threat to the country, Judge Lawrence Silberman of the D.C. Circuit of the Court of Appeals warned in a blistering dissent that called for courts to revisit libel laws. He said, "It should be borne in mind that the first step taken by any potential authoritarian or dictatorial regime is to gain control of communications, particularly the delivery of news." He wrote, "It is fair to conclude, therefore, that one-party control of the press and media is a threat to a viable democracy." The New York Times and Washington Post are virtually democratic broadsheets, he went on, and the news section of the Wall Street Journal leans in the same direction. He said, also mentioning the Associated Press and most large newspapers in the country, "Nearly all television, network, and cable," he said, "is a Democratic Party trumpet. Silicon Valley also has enormous influence over the distribution of news, and it similarly filters news delivery in ways favorable to the Democratic Party." He wrote, highlighting the shocking suppression of stories about Joe Biden and his family when he was running for president. And in that case, Twitter and Facebook censored media outlets that reported accurately about the Biden family's dealings with foreign entities. Twitter suspended users, including then-White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, for merely sharing accurate information, and prevented people from sharing the information even privately on their platforms. Facebook said it would censor coverage of the Biden family corruption pending a fact check, an unprecedented privilege given to Biden in the closing days of one of the closest presidential elections in history. Only a few major media outlets are not controlled by the left, Silberman noted, citing Fox News, the New York Post, and the Wall Street Journal. "It should be sobering for those concerned about news bias," he said, "that those institutions are controlled by a single man and his son. Will a lone holdout remain in what is otherwise a frighteningly orthodox media culture? After all," he noted, "there are serious efforts to muzzle Fox News." He then cited Tim Grossclose's book, Left Turn, which empirically argued that media bias, even a decade ago, gave Democrat candidates an 8-to-10-point advantage. "And now, a decade after the book's publication," he wrote, "the press and media do not even pretend to be neutral news services." The First Amendment guarantees a free press to foster a vibrant trade in ideas, Silberman concluded, but a biased press can distort the marketplace. And when the media has proven its willingness, if not eagerness, to so distort, it is a profound mistake to stand by unjustified legal rules that serve only to enhance the press's power. Mindful, however, of the difficulty of marginalizing powerful media oligarchs, funding alternatives, and revisiting libel law, the public also needs to demand more of itself. It is human nature to be jealous and seek to tear others down. The public feeds on such gossip and lies in the press. One way to cut off the supply of propaganda that is harmful to the republic is to not demand it or be open to it. Americans should repent of this gossip mongering and turn away from lurid news stories and propaganda. The commandment against bearing false witness is explained in my Lutheran tradition as meaning that we should, quote, fear and love God so that we do not tell lies about our neighbor, betray him, slander him, or hurt his reputation, but defend him, speak well of him, and explain everything in the kindest possible way. No matter what others do, this is what we should hold ourselves to when we create and consume news. But in the spirit of Cato the Elder, with an eye toward preserving this great republic, media, delenda est.